talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Good morning and welcome to the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. Today is June 13th, and I'm Tom Stockman.
I'm Jim Batts.
And I'm Stephen Tronicek.
Stephen Tronicek is here filling in for Michelle. Stephen is a contributing reviewer for We Are Movie Geeks. And Stephen's big secret is he's still a teenager. How old are you, Stephen?
I'm 16.
16. He's like the cub reporter for We Are. He's like the Jimmy Olsen of We Are Movie Geeks.
But hopefully you won't take a bullet to the head like he does in Batman v Superman.
Oh, you just don't talk about that.
Okay. Where do you go to high school, Stephen?
I go to high school in Maplewood Richmond Heights High School.
Maplewood Richmond Heights High School. Okay. So what year were you born?
1999.
You were born the same year as my daughter. When's your birthday?
July 22nd.
She's July 23rd. You're one day older than my daughter.
Unbelievable.
Crazy. What's it like being a teenage movie geek in 2016?
Well, it's really good because we have, like, I guess we have just have all the movies from the 90s to look up to.
Yeah.
You have Fight Club and all that.
Well, you're lucky because you have easy access to films compared to, you know, Tom and I, or especially me.
Definitely.
Back in the days, because I remember, there not being home video or streaming or cable. And if you missed a movie, you pretty much were out of luck unless it showed up at a rare revival house, or it played the late night TV, usually hacked up and edited, commercials.
In some ways, though, I'm kind of glad I didn't grow up in the VHS era, because I saw movies all the time. And back when I was your age, the Tivoli was a repertory cinema, and they would show a different double feature every other night.
Oh, wow.
And I was up at the Tivoli constantly. I was always driving up to the Tivoli. So I didn't... You know, if I had been growing up in the VHS age, I would have chosen movies. In some ways, I had movies chosen for me. I didn't really have any control of what I saw, but I went and saw everything anyway. And I think that was a good way to really get well-rounded in my movie geekdom, so to speak.
And occasionally, I said, a college would run
College run, or, yeah. Or, oh, yeah, 16-millimeter prints. By the time I was in college, they were showing movies on campus like every night.
I try to get educated on some film by going down to the Webster University auditorium. Oh,
they have a great film series there. Yeah.
Winifred, yeah.
I went there when I was your age. I mean, they've been doing that film series since the early 70s. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I was there Friday night. I saw The Picture of Dorian Gray.
Oh, that's right. That's right. We talked about that coming up last week. And so did they have a good crowd for it, Tom?
If you call 11 people a good crowd.
I don't. No. That's too bad.
So how long have you been a movie buff? Your whole life there, Stephen?
No. I started around back in 2010 whenever my grandfather took me to go see the Coen Brothers' True Grit film.
Oh, yeah. That was the movie that turned you into a movie buff?
Well, that's actually, okay. I saw that and it really impressed me. But 2013, I saw Cloud Atlas, actually, which I know a lot of people didn't like.
I liked Cloud Atlas.
But I really like Cloud Atlas.
Notice my silence.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I notice your silence. Then in 2014, I just decided to start a film blog because I was watching, like, a good 400 films per year by that point. And then it just kept going. It's been 2 years in May.
Yeah, and then you've got your blog. Tell us about your blog. What's it called?
Filmanalyst.weebly.com.
Say it again. I'm sorry.
Filmanalyst.weebly.com.
.weebly.com.
Yeah, Weebly's like the free website.
The hosting
generator.
Thing, yeah.
And you review a lot of movies on there.
Uh-huh. I try to get at everything that I can. Mm-hmm. During some of the awards seasons, I miss a couple of big ones because I don't have the money to go see them.
Yeah. So what's your favorite movie of all time?
I have a couple listed here. Like, I was a big fan of Boyhood, which I know it's recent, but I don't know. That movie really spoke to me. And
it kind of sticks with you, too, doesn't it? You kind of think about it,
Schindler's List.
There you go.
That's my favorite Spielberg.
Yeah, that's an interesting choice,
Even though it's kind of dour, it really, like, Spielberg's camera on that is really, really dynamic and really enjoy it. Almost Famous.
Yeah, there you go.
That's a great film. Yeah,
Goodfellas.
Goodfellas, can't go wrong.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights. That's mm-hmm. one yeah. of my favorites.
That's classic. That's made before you were born.
Yeah, that
way too mature for you, young man.
That's right.
Well, no, that's actually one of the films that really got me into movies.
Oh yeah,
I like the long epics that you can kind of bleed out. And
so
you
believe
the
old adage that Ebert said, a good movie is never too long and a bad movie is never too short.
That's yes, yeah.
Who are some of your favorite directors, Steven?
And well, Martin Scorsese, of course.
Of course.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Paul Thomas Anderson, as I mentioned, Boogie Nights, Wes Anderson, Steven Spielberg, Quentin Tarantino, Joel and Ethan Coen, Darren Aronofsky, and mm-hmm. David Fincher.
There you go.
Oh,
well, all the hitters. Contemporary standards.
Really big fan of like Black Swan and Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah, Requiem for a Dream's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And Black Swan was really entertaining when we saw that. That opened the St. Louis Film Festival
a few years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was nice. A fun night.
That was. That was November of 2010.
Yeah, they had it at the packed house at the High Point. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that must have been great.
Yeah, it was great. What about, do you have some favorite directors who are like dead? Like old directors?
Okay, let me think. Well, I'm a huge fan of Orson Welles' work.
Okay.
Yes.
He would qualify for that category.
Howard Hawks.
There you go.
What is his name? Frank Capra.
Oh,
It's
yes.
a Wonderful
yeah.
Life.
Yes.
Yeah. Beautiful film.
Yes. Which one of our cohorts does not like at all. And some people just, that film rubs them the wrong way for some reason. I don't know. Just
see
let
that.
It in. Yeah. You know, it's pretty great.
Is it Federico Fellini?
Yes,
Eight and a Half was incredible. Jean-Luc Godard's not dead.
He is not dead. We just saw his new movie at the SLIFF last year.
Goodbye to Language.
Yeah, in 3D.
Have you seen? You mentioned Orson Welles, and of course Citizen Kane. Everyone mentions, but have you seen Touch of Evil?
No, I have not. I do have Third Man at Home though.
Oh, that's a great one. But that was Carol Reed directed
Reed,
but
yeah.
The Touch of Evil that opening. You know what? What is it about? Minutes or something.
I've seen that before, though, yeah.
It's pretty incredible.
All right, let's move on to performers. Who are some of your favorite actors and actresses?
Favorite actors? Well, my favorite actor is... This is going to sound like millennial speaking, but Leonardo DiCaprio. For his performance in Wolf of Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think his performance in The Revenant's a great performance, but it is a lot of just, you know, physical
huffing
acting.
Huffing
and puffing, yeah. But Wolf of Wall Street is like the perfect combination of his confidence in a role and just his method of a role. It's just a great performance. I have Denzel Washington here on my list too. I watched Flight last night.
He's amazing in that.
That was incredible.
Yeah.
And, of course, Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh, when you mentioned Leo, I hope you've gone back. I know it's a ways away, but I hope you saw What's Eating Gilbert Grape.
Oh, of course.
That's maybe
yeah,
his first
I should
really
have brought that up in the first place, actually.
But really, though, what's your favorite Charles Bronson movie?
What movies have I seen with Charles? Once Upon a Time in the West.
There you go. That's my favorite as well.
That's the great one, yeah.
All right, what about actresses, or do we care about actresses?
Well, of course we care. Yeah,
but they're not as interesting.
Natalie Portman, definitely.
She's a cutie.
She also has delivered some pretty heavy hitters. Like, of course, Black Swan. Her performance is incredible. Right. Leon the Professional as a child actress. That is that's just very impressive.
I saw that before you were born, by the way. Get out of here.
You gonna keep saying?
Uh-huh.
Cool. Closer. I thought she was very good in Closer.
She was nominated
that
for
was
that.
Great.
Yeah, it's an interesting film. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mike Nichols directed that, didn't he?
Yeah,
that's right.
Did The Graduate.
Mm. Oh, you know The Graduate. That's good.
Yeah, that's
good.
a great film.
That's a great film. What do you think, speaking of contemporary actresses, about, say, Emma Stone or Jennifer Lawrence?
Definitely.
You enjoy those too? Yeah.
I think that Jennifer Lawrence is sometimes a little bit overrated. Like, especially her performance in American Hustle. I didn't really like American Hustle, to be honest.
See, I differ. That was one of my favorites.
I didn't like it that much either. I liked it when I saw it. It's a movie I've never had any desire to revisit.
I felt like Russell was trying to copy Scorsese's type of aesthetic. But definitely Jennifer Lawrence. I think she was very good in Silver Linings Playbook. I'm a big fan of Shailene Woodley's work in The Descendants with Alexander Payne.
Yeah. I will say that Jennifer Lawrence, I almost called her J-Law. Don't do that. She seemed a little bored in the newest X-Men.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah. I think she's kind of not like the new X-Men film.
A lot of folks are.
But, what's your favorite Pam Grier movie?
Yeah, that I would not know.
You never seen Jackie Brown?
Oh, okay, yes. Now I know you're talking about. Yes, Jackie Brown's very good.
It is. That's
not
actually
my favorite
Tarantino.
Though, but
it's my favorite Tarantino.
Reservoir Dogs is mine.
Okay. I saw that.
That's a good one too.
I saw that before we were born. Okay, you know what we're going to do now? We're going to call Michelle. But by the way, though, thanks for being with us this morning. You do a good job of contributing some reviews for us. What's the last movie you reviewed for us?
Now You See Me Too.
You didn't review that for us, though.
Wait, what? Oh, what other films I reviewed for you? Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I reviewed... What was it?
Was it that music documentary about the
guy
from Guns N' Roses?
Yeah, It's So Easy. Other Lies.
Yeah,
which
okay.
Was, I did the foreign film Mustang.
Oh, that's right.
Guys, that was excellent.
Yeah, that was up for best foreign film, wasn't it? Yeah.
But Son of Saul won, which
that was the only
should have.
Yeah. Well, Mustang was the only one I didn't see, I think, of those nominees, so there you go.
All right, let's call Michelle. And here she is. It's Michelle McHugh calling from, where are you calling from, Texas?
Texas.
What's going on in Texas?
Not much.
Not much.
It's warm.
Have you found the local art house?
the Alamo?
No. I have found an IMAX theater.
Oh, there you go. Have you seen anything yet?
No, I have plans to go see a movie today.
Oh, what are you going to see?
I am going to go see... Brace Yourself, Me Before You.
I thought you were going to say Warcraft.
Jim didn't like Warcraft.
Not after your review. There's no way I'm going to go see Warcraft.
Okay. All right, well, let's talk about the top 12 of the box office. Last week, Jim and I went backwards. It was crazy.
Yeah, no, that was fun. That was a lot of fun. So when I do it, you can do the 12 backwards.
Okay.
That's a fine idea.
All right.
Okay, so here are the top 12 domestic weekend box office estimates as of Sunday, June 12th from ComScore. In the number one spot is The Conjuring 2. The Warner Brothers sequel netted $40.4 million.
That's a lot. Did it beat Conjuring 1?
Yes, it did.
Okay.
Well, good.
Yes, it did. And this is good news for Warner Brothers because of, you know, the last, four or five movies have just been not so good.
Uh-huh.
So this is good news for them.
Yeah, it probably didn't cost much more than that to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it didn't. But, good to see that. And I'll bet it doesn't drop off much by next weekend also.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good word of mouth.
Number two is Universal's Warcraft with a $24.4 million. While it's technically a bomb in the U.S., according to Variety, on Sunday, yesterday, Warcraft racked up a massive $156 million over its first 5 days in China, setting a new record for the biggest debut for a foreign release in the country's history.
Wow. How sad.
Yeah,
so people in China went to it in droves.
Mm-hmm.
They should get out more.
This is good news for Legendary and Universal, the backers of the 160 million video game adaptation. Warcraft's performance in China flew past the high-water mark set for a foreign release in 2015 with Avengers Age of Ultron. Despite the tepid response from stateside audiences, Warcraft is shaping up to be a box office hit. It's a sign of the importance of foreign audiences. That's why most movies these days get released overseas first before they hit the States. We may be seeing another Warcraft movie.
Oh, boy. Not me.
I hope I don't.
I'll go see it.
Okay. Steven's offered to review Warcraft 2 for We Are Movie Geeks.
Yeah, they're going to be like, Jim Bapp can't review that anymore. number three is the sequel, Now You See Me 2 from Lionsgate. That movie brought in a respectable $23 million. Okay. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows was number four.
Did you see that, Steven?
No. I saw the first one.
Nobody in this room has seen Teenage
Mutant
Ninja.
I did not want to do that again.
Well, we are giving away random engagement passes. So there's that chance right there.
Yeah.
Paramount's sequel came in at $14.8 million. Okay. So expect to see another Ninja Turtles, too. At number five is X-Men Apocalypse. 20th Century Fox's movie brought in another $10 million. the next chapter in the superhero franchise now stands at a whopping worldwide total of $478 million.
Okay.
Yeah, it's, yeah, still, you know, it's after, you know,
after the greatness of First Class, though.
Yeah, well, yeah.
First Class is, yeah.
It's First Class.
It's First Class, exactly. How very good, Tom. Me Before You is number 6 with $9.2 million. The film right now stands at $55 million globally, which is good. You know, another good news for Warner Brothers.
Yeah, Michelle. If that, I hope you haven't read the Entertainment Weekly piece on Me Before You that's in the current issue. That might spoil the film for you.
Is that about the ending?
Yeah.
You know, I started to, and then I put on the brakes. So I have that. Yes, on my list to read.
Yeah, I had a theory as to what the controversy was last week on the podcast, and it seems like that's true, I guess. So, yeah.
Right. You know, people like the young adult novels, and this one's set overseas, set in Britain. It's got that whole, you know, and good for Amelia Clarke. She's making quite a name for herself. At number 7 is Sony's The Angry Birds movie. The film brought in another $6.7 million. It's still doing well overseas.
Did you see that, Steven?
No, I did not end up seeing that.
Okay, that's okay.
Good for you. Alice Through the Looking Glass, Disney's film, was number 8 with $5.5 million. It's doing less than expected considering all these, you know, adaptation, live action that Disney's doing. That one's not doing so well.
Maybe because it sucks.
They do have Beauty and the Beast coming up next year. So at number 9 is Captain America: Civil War. They're running an additional $4.3 million and is well past the $1 billion mark globally. And climbing.
That's good.
Well deserved.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. And Disney's other juggernaut, The Jungle Book, comes in at number 10 with $2.7 million. The film, as of yesterday, is just shy of the $1 billion total with $909 million. So that's going to also pass. That's also going to pass. And last night, we saw on the Tonys, Disney debuted the first teaser trailer for Momoa.
Oh, okay.
Their big animated spectacle coming out in November. And number 11 is Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising. Universal's movie brought in $2.1 million. And The Nice Guy, starring Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling, rounds out the top 12 with $2.1 million. Opening Friday, June 17th, is the new action comedy Central Intelligence, starring Kevin Hart and Dwayne Mark Johnson. And Disney's long-awaited sequel to Finding Nemo, Finding Dory, also opens, and that features the voices of Ellen DeGeneres, Albert Brooks, Ed O'Neill, Ty Burrell, Eugene Levy, and Diane Keaton. Also opening in limited releases from Roadside Attractions is Genius, starring Colin Firth, Jude Law, Nicole Kidman, Laura Linney, Guy Pearce, and Dominic West.
All right. Well, we'll be back Well, good. Hey, when are you going to be back in the studio with us?
I don't know.
No.
Right now, I don't have a date. But I will let you know
okay.
when I do.
Well, you better. All right. Well, thanks for calling in. Sounds like an exciting weekend at the box office.
Yeah, all right. Definitely.
Well, if you're not here next week, we'll try to call you again next Monday.
All right. Sounds good.
All right.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks, Michelle.
See you, Michelle.
Bye.
All right. Goodbye.
Okay, now let's start reviewing some movies, doggone it. Jim saw Warcraft and loved it.
If we do not unite, our world will perish.
This doesn't need to happen. There is one who may help us.
For orcs, there is no other life but war. No, but with the humans' help, there could be.
Why are you here?
To save our people.
Yes. I loved all the mail I got about it afterwards. Oh, my goodness. The gamers just piled on me the last few days.
That's right.
Oh, they're angry group there.
They're a group of angry birds.
I was going to make some nerd jokes, but I'm not going to. I'm not going to go down there because Lord knows they called me enough names the last few days. You were just talking that one of them called me an elitist snob that only likes French-speaking black and white films. And this is the same reviewer that gave Captain America: Civil War 5 stars just a few weeks ago. And
but that's a French black and white film. Right?
Yeah, right. That's right. That's as snobby as you can get for good. goodness sakes. Well, that's only because Disney's paying me off for, you know, giving good reviews to the... They're paying us, all of us critics, for the good reviews.
So they're upset because you gave Warcraft 1/2 of 5 stars.
And that's mostly for the technical people. I just imagine these poor folks, you know, hunched over their laptops trying to get, you know, the last bit of flames on an arrow to look exactly right. I know that a lot of time went into this, but it's just such junk. It's just, and the real tragedy, and Steve and I talked about this a little bit before the podcast, is that it's directed by Duncan Jones.
I think some people had a glimmer of hope that this might be better than the trailer because of Jones's name attached to
it. He's a talented guy, and this just seems to be, you know, product of the, I think I called it in the review, product. Mm-hmm. It's just an extension of the different Warcraft merchandising empire. You know, I guess it's been around like 22 years, something like that, the different Warcraft incarnations. I don't know if it started out as a board game.
It started out as an RTS, a real-time strategy game called Warcraft Orcs and Humans, and then transitioned into a MMO, massive multiplayer online game called World of Warcraft.
Someone was complaining that...
thanks for clearing that up, by
the way. Yes, that you didn't understand it. This was a parody of Lord of the Rings. And it's like, well, where's the humor? Yeah. There's none in this. And I felt bad for the talented actors involved in it, particularly Dominic Cooper, who's saddled with this thankless role of the Prince of the Human Kingdom. Basically, I'll try to sum it up the best I can. There's a world of different orcs who are kind of these hulking, pointy-eared, you know, big-fanged creatures, and they're all motion-capture creatures. I think they're led by Toby Kebbell, who played Koba in the last Planet of the Apes film. They're sort of being controlled by one of their own, who's a sorcerer, and he's devised a way to open up a portal to this, to the human world, and he needs bodies, life force, in order to power this portal. And they're all going over to the human world to fight it. And Travis Kimmel, who I believe is from the TV show The Vikings, he's the head warrior for the king, who's played by Dominic West. And they're trying to fight them. And one of the orcs is a little more human than the other ones, and it's played by Paula Patton. And I mentioned she's got these ridiculous lower fangs, sort of tusks, and she sounded at times like an actress from, you know, a bad horror film from the 50s and 60s, a Hammer wannabe, were trying to speak with vampire fangs in their mouth. And it's just, it's so ludicrous. They're starting at, you know, there's a little romance hinted off, you know, between her and Travis Kimmel. There's the Guardian, played by Ben Foster, and he's wasted in it, and it's just a lot of flash and just, you know, pixels fighting pixels, just dull as dishwater.
Sounds pretty darn dreadful. So, Jim does not recommend Warcraft, even though it made $24.4 million over the weekend and made Jim some enemies.
Yeah, I don't recommend you complaining about it to anyone.
All right, let's move along. Now we're going to review Conjuring 2.
You believe us, don't you?
Sensing a presence?
I'm not sensing anything. All I can sense is their own fear.
I reviewed Conjuring 2 at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. I gave it a massive 4 out of 5 stars. I like Conjuring 2. I thought it was a worthy sequel. It's the further adventures of Lorraine and Ed Warren, played again by Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson. And they're these Catholic paranormal investigators. And it actually opens with them performing a seance at the old Amityville house back in 1976. I didn't know that the Warrens were part of the Amityville story, but I guess they were.
Oh, and that opening shot with those windows, you know exactly where you are.
No doubt. Is that house still standing, I wonder?
I actually think it's on the market now.
They should turn it into kind of museum or something like they did with the Christmas story.
But Ed and Lorraine are kind of like the James Bond, you know, like secret agents for the Catholic Church. They even have their sort of M coming in and giving them their newest assignment.
That's true. This is a pretty good movie. Then it switches over to England, and there's this young single mother of four, played by Frances O'Connor. And her house over in England is starting to become haunted by some sort of demon, and they think it's related to this old man who died in a chair, previous tenant, but the kids are getting possessed, and furniture is moving around, and a little girl is talking in voices, and it's pretty spooky. They call a priest, Well, actually, the first they call the cops, and the cops show up, and they see the furniture moving, and one of the cops says, I think I know a priest we can call. Well, the priest calls Ed and Lorraine, and Ed and Lorraine fly in from the U.S. and
oh, you got a call.
That's right. And and they battle this house, and apparently this house is a true story, too. This is like the England's equivalent of the Amityville.
Yeah,
I forget what they call it.
The Enfield Poltergeist?
Yeah, the Enfield Poltergeist. Which
Yeah, there's a reoccurring gag that they don't milk for too many. They do it a couple of times where, you know, something horrible happens and the person comes to someone in charge, like the little girl goes to her mother and says, oh, things are crazy, things are moving, oh, you're just imagining it. And then something that they witness happens, and then the next shot is whoever is running out of the house.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It runs 2 hours and 13 minutes, which seems like an excessive length, and it is.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's not like one of these, you know, Blumhouse movies that should be 90 minutes. It's very complex. It's got a really good script that takes its time. It's sort of interesting. I said in my review, it's almost like two separately filmed, you know, style wise. Stories of possession, because you've got Lorraine, who's haunted by this demon nun, and those sequences are directed like cheesy horror movies with a lot of jump cuts and dropped frames and loud spooks. And then when it goes to England, it sort of slows down and it tells a more of a conventional, deliberately paced horror film. And then at the end, these two styles sort of come together. It's really well done. But like I say, it could have been maybe 15 or 20 minutes shorter. Maybe clocking in at just under 2 hours might have helped a little bit, because I think some of the suspense becomes a little diluted when you've got scenes like Patrick Wilson singing an Elvis Presley song in its entirety.
Yeah. It seems it took a while to get going. While with the first one, they sort of hit the ground running.
Yeah.
You know, that was my main problem with it. But certainly, it's a good sequel. Certainly, miles better than Annabelle.
The quasi sequel from a couple of years ago. Yeah, but it's very good. I highly recommend The Conjuring 2, which made $40.4 million, probably due to my positive review.
And we'll be seeing the Warrens again, I'm sure. I'm surprised there wasn't a credit at the end. Yeah. Ed and Lorraine will return.
they'll probably get their own TV series.
That would actually be cool.
That would be cool. Let's move on. Jim saw something that opens Friday, and it is called Deepon.
Yes.
What is this Deepon movie, Jim?
Probably going to open
Is this one of these black and white French-speaking movies?
I'm so crazy about that. I only praise. No. This is a well done film, and actually won the Palme d'Or, I guess is how you pronounce it, at Cannes last year. And it is in a foreign language. It starts off in war torn Sri Lanka. The fella who eventually becomes Deepan leaves the military, and he decides he's going to assume the identity of a deceased person because they've got their passport, and he hooks up with a woman who is wanting to get out of the country too, and she ends up grabbing an orphan with her, a 9-year-old orphan, and they're going to pass as this deceased family so that they can get on a boat. And she thinks they're going to England. Actually, they end up in Paris. The next time you see this military guy, he's on the streets of Paris selling these glow-in-the-dark tchotchkes to tourists, you know, €2, trying to sell these little things, and of course they're having to evade the cops. And finally he hears a position, a job at an apartment complex that's kind of been, you know, run down. It's on the outskirts of town, and he goes there, and he and his family are going to live for free there, and he's having to tinker around. But what he doesn't know until he gets there is one of the complexes, one of the buildings, has been completely taken over by a gang of drug runners. Mm-hmm. And so there's constantly cars coming in, shots being fired, and he's a little unnerved with that, although his wife gets hired by one of the drug dealers to take care of his infirm uncle, and she's doing that. And eventually things get out of hand. There's drive-by shootings, and Deepan is pushed over the limit. He tells them he's had enough, and it sort of becomes sort of almost like a Death Wish type of thing. I think there was one of the Death Wish films in which, you know, they were attacking the complex where Paul lived or something, right? Mm. And he's having to, you know, take back the streets, I guess.
Sure. I think that's the plot of all of them. That's actually the plot of part three.
I heard from somewhere that it was kind of like Taxi Driver.
Yeah, a little bit. He's just kind of pushed over the edge, and he's not going to, you know, take this anymore, pretty much. And it is in the, you know, French language and the Sri Lankan language, and it's very interesting to see them trying to adjust to life there. And I don't know, it's if you kind of, you know, go for, you know, looking at foreign cultures and the way, you know, cultures clash, you might enjoy this. You know, it's fairly well done. There's strong performances from all the unknown actors in it. So, you know, as far as foreign films go, I think it's pretty good bet to take in.
All right. So Jim recommends Deepan. That opens Friday, I assume, at one of the Landmark theaters.
I believe so. Yeah.
All right, let's move on. We only have one more movie to review, and that is Now You See Me 2.
People see the horsemen as noble Robin Hoods. But I believe their first act was just the setup for an even bigger reveal.
The only person in the room that's seen that is young Steven. So, Steven, take it away. How is Now You See Me 2?
Well, Now You See Me 2 is certainly better than the first one.
Yeah.
I really didn't like the first one. I thought it was kind of preposterous.
It was. It was ridiculous.
And the main reason why I really didn't connect with the first one, I think, is the fact that the characters in Now You See Me, well, they're always supposed to be ahead of the audience. They're always supposed to be smarter than us. So we never really emotionally connect with them. And, like, we just marvel at them. But what Now You See Me 2 does better than the first one is that it introduces a type of character that you can actually connect with. Like, the kind of, honestly, a kind of more incapable character on the team, doesn't really know what they're doing. Like, and that's the Lizzie Kaplan Lula character.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say Dave Franco for
a moment. No. She's really, really, really kind of, she actually gets to be kind of crazy and funny in this movie, which gives us something to latch onto as all this ridiculous stuff is just happening. And just like the first one, it's all ridiculous, like all the weird magic show stuff and the preposterous.
Do they give an explanation as to why the Isla Fisher character isn't there any longer?
They do.
Okay, good.
In like two sentences, but they do.
Yeah, that's good. That's right.
But
like they wrote out Snow White in the Huntsman.
Oh my gosh. Well, they didn't completely write her out. She was screaming in front of the mirror.
Yeah, you could see her from the back, yeah.
But then Daniel Radcliffe, of course, gets introduced, and he's one of the big selling points, I think, of the film.
Is he the bad guy in it, kind of?
Wasn't Michael Caine the bad guy in the first one?
No, it looks like Morgan Freeman was the bad guy first one, yeah.
See, it gets really, really twisty in a way that, and it doesn't really explain as much as it should, like, especially in the story-wise, which is kind of confusing because the movie's all about explaining how they get these tricks done or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, like, once you move into the third act of the film, it feels like it's all a little jumbled because it hasn't really explained the motivations of the villains, and it's just kind of, you know, just riling forward. Like, you eventually kind of get an idea of what the motivations could be, but again, it's just all so preposterous and out of hand that...
Well, I heard we get a second Woody Harrelson in this.
Woody Harrelsons.
Is it like
in
another
movie.
Dimension or something?
No. He has a twin brother, apparently, that never appeared in the first.
Just like you do.
Yeah, and he has like this ghastly tan and this curly brown hair. It's really weird.
So you reviewed Now You See Me 2 for your blog. Okay, do you do the star system over there?
I give numbers out of 10.
Oh, you
I give it a 6 out of 10. Like,
so that would be a 3 on our
Weird
Movie
Geeks. It's really, really entertaining at times.
Okay.
And the Lizzie Kaplan character does kind of help get the audience connecting to the Four Horsemen. Unlike the first one, but again, it's nonsense. But it's the fun kind.
But
you can
setting things up for a part 3, maybe.
Probably.
Well, if you can't have Isla Fisher, then Lizzie Kaplan's a pretty good son.
No doubt. All right. So Steven thinks Now You See Me 2 is entertaining but flawed. Tonight we're seeing Central Intelligence.
I'm in the CIA.
Are you joking with me right now?
Drop your weapon! Do it now!
I got a plan. Might get us both killed, but if it works, it'll be a totally boss story. Cool?
No, it's not cool.
Cool.
No, I said it's not cool.
I found it interesting. I did a little research that it's directed by a fellow named Rawson Marshall Thurber, and he directed a couple of my favorite comedies of the last few years, or some really good comedies. Where the Millers was his last big one, and he also did the Dodgeball movie.
No, I love the Dodgeball movie. Yeah.
So that's encouraging. But the fact that it's clocking in way over 2 hours.
Was a mistake. I think that was an email we got from Allied that said it was 2 hours and 15 minutes. I was looking at something yesterday, and I think it's 1 hour and 54 minutes, which is much more reasonable.
Getting a Judd Apatow character.
Yeah, that's right.
So I'll be reviewing Central Intelligence. You can look for my review Thursday night over at wearemoviegeeks.com. Tomorrow night we're seeing Finding Dory.
Oh, that's awesome.
I remembered something. That's not possible. Is it? Okay, is it like a picture in your head? And then you think I've seen this before? I just used the word before, which means I'm remembering something. What was I talking about?
Somewhere. Yeah, Andrew Stanton directing this one.
Does that open this Friday?
I saw the first one in theaters whenever I was four.
so did my daughter, who's your age. She saw it like three times.
Oh, yes. This is a great movie.
Looking
forward to the visuals and some of the voice work in it. And, this is a Pixar that's definitely a... This'll keep me satisfied until they finally do Incredibles 2.
Oh, man.
All right, so who's reviewing Finding Dory?
I believe Melissa Howland is going to review it for us down in the West Coast.
All right, so look for Melissa's review of Finding Dory Thursday or maybe Friday over at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. Okay, now let's talk about some local stuff. Saturday, I saw 42nd Street over the High Points, part of their classic film series. Big crowd. And good. Harry Hamm introduces the classic film series once a month at the High Point, but he didn't show up. He was supposed to show up. Huh. So they had me introduce it.
Oh.
That was only the second time I've introduced the classic film series.
Tops and Taps, Tom.
I was. I had to wing it, but I did fine. And then we actually voted on next month. Usually they don't announce next month until like the week before, but we're going to show an Alfred Hitchcock movie, so we had them vote between Notorious and Suspicion. Man.
I'll tell you what I'd vote for.
What, Suspicion?
No, I'd vote for Notorious.
Well, that's what most people voted for, so that's what they're showing next month. Okay. But they just showed Notorious at SLIFF, St. Louis International Film Festival, last November, because they did that Truffaut Hitchcock documentary, and that was the Hitchcock movie that they showed alongside it.
Now, Suspicion is with Carrie also and Joan Fontaine.
That's
right.
She won the Oscar for that.
Yeah. But Notorious, I guess that Ingrid Bergman, Cary Grant chemistry gets the best of folks. And Claude Rains is a great villain.
But I prefer Suspicion just because I haven't seen Suspicion as many times as I've seen Notorious. In fact, I've seen Notorious on the big screen and never Suspicion. But we had to go with the democracy, and more people voted for Notorious, so that'll be next month. I don't know if Harry Hamm will be back or not. Also, locally, this weekend at the Tivoli. Last weekend, we did... what did we do?
The Breakfast Club?
Yes, the Breakfast Club. And there was a big crowd for that. I had Breakfast Club trivia and tons of stuff to hand out. This weekend is Fantastic Planet. It is a French Czechoslovakian co-production animated film from 1973. You ever seen that, Steven?
No, I haven't.
It's interesting.
I haven't seen it in 43 years.
I
probably won't see it again.
It was very popular with that midnight crowd and their refreshments, if you know what I mean. Yeah.
I remember it was the first animated film I ever saw that had nudity in it. I was like, wow, there's like naked women in this movie.
I saw that before the Bakshi stuff.
Yeah, it was kind of around that same time, but I wouldn't have seen
only
the Bakshi.
Only Bakshi I've seen is the Lord of the Rings.
Well, you don't know about those early ones.
The Cat,
yeah. So that's Fantastic Planet this weekend. And something I announced last night on Facebook, my big announcement. You guys see my big announcement?
I saw that.
It was really Facebook, I mean, it was trending all over the place. It really shook up Facebook. Anyways, I think I mentioned this on this show before, but I will be reprising the King Bagot Tribute. The King Bagot Tribute was an event I hosted November of 2014 over at Webster U as part of St. Louis International Film Festival, but we're bringing it back. King Bagot was a silent film star. 100 years ago, King Bagot was the biggest star in the world, literally. He was huge, and he was the first actor to have his name above the title and the first actor to really be credited with acting in a movie. And I'll explain why when I deliver my lecture on King Bagot. That's going to be September 28th, which is a Wednesday, at the Missouri History Museum there in Forest Park. And we're going to show the 1913 version of Ivanhoe, which runs 49 minutes. We showed a 35mm print of this 1913 version of Ivanhoe, and we did this show back in 2014, and that had Dutch intertitles. So I had to stand there at the podium and translate the Dutch intertitles into English while the Rats and People Motion Picture Orchestra was accompanying the film, and we rehearsed together, so they kind of brought the music down when I had to talk. And it worked out really well, but now we've got this movie transferred digitally, and a local guy actually burned these translated subtitles onto the DVD. So we're going to be able to show it with English intertitles, so I won't have to stand there and yell throughout the movie. So that'll be the 28th of September, and I will also be delivering my illustrated 40-minute PowerPoint lecture on the life and career of King Bagot. And it is free, by the way, so put that on your calendar right now.
But will the lecture be on the final?
It will be. Okay. What did you think of Capone the other night, Jim? I did 16-millimeter Capone.
I caught most of it there.
That's right, you left.
Yeah, I thought the color was good. It was see some of the old Corman standbys. Yeah. I got to see Dick Miller in there. I got to see Babyface Stallone in there.
Yeah.
But, it's okay. I think that, Gazzara is a pretty good Capone. I'm not going to, go past, De Niro in the Untouchables.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's okay. Flick.
Or Neville Brand on the Untouchables.
Yes, in the TV show.
It wasn't as good as I remember. but it was still, it was a pretty fun 70s gangster movie. But unfortunately, it was a damn TV print. I had a feeling it might have been a TV print based on something that Roger, who owns the print, said. I don't remember that nude scene with Susan Blakely. I watched it. And I'm like, how can you forget that? It's like the greatest nude scene of the 70s.
Well, I was fairly close to the screen, and I could tell when, lines were being dubbed and that something much nastier was actually being said. I can read lips well enough to kind of figure that out.
And then that scene, which, I saw that movie at the theater when I was 13, and I had this big crush on Susan Blakely because the Rich Man, Poor Man TV miniseries had just aired. And so I had a big thing for her. So then I actually rode my bike up to the theater and asked some strange old man in the parking lot to buy my ticket. I don't think Steven appreciates how difficult, we talked about this last week, how difficult it is seeing R-rated movies back in the 70s when we were kids.
Yeah.
You kids today, you get to watch all this stuff on your phones if you want. But back then, it was a struggle. It was work to see an R-rated
film.
It's
still a little difficult to get into one of
now,
those.
Now, Capone came out a couple of years after The Godfather, right?
Yeah,
so I'm assuming that's why it had some nudity and much more violent, lots of language.
But there's this great scene where she's in bed naked with Ben Gazzara, Susan Blakely, and she gets out of bed and nothing is left to the imagination. But this TV print on 60mm, they had that scene, but she's wearing a nightie. They obviously filmed a secondary take. An alternate take for television, and shucks.
Yeah, it looked like Gazzara was kind of wearing a prosthetic in his mouth to kind of puff up his jaws in a couple of scenes, kind of do a little Godfather type of thing there, too.
Yeah. All right, well, anyways, next month, which will be July 5th, I'm showing on 16mm print of Day the Earth Stood Still, and double feature with Richard Pryor, Live on the Sunset Strip, to concert movie from 1982. And Steven can't go, because the Way Out Club is a 21-plus club. Sorry,
that's
dude. You better go get a fake ID. We are doing a tribute to Coffin Joe. You know who Coffin Joe is?
No.
Okay, Coffin Joe was a Brazilian horror filmmaker in the 60s and 70s. And he made these really weird horror movies. They weren't imported to the U.S. when they were new films. And so Coffin Joe was sort of unknown to American film fans until kind of the 90s when some of these things started showing up on grainy bootleg VHSs and things like that. And we started discovering Coffin Joe. Coffin Joe, he kind of looks a little like the Babadook. He's got this top hat and this beard and these long, pointy fingernails. And he's looking for the perfect woman to mate with. And these movies were unbelievably gory for their day. And he kills people with spiders and snakes and drops boulders on people's heads. And
he's basically playing the same character in all the films.
There's a local friend of mine named Raymond Castile. And Raymond Castile was a huge, huge, huge fan of Coffin Joe. And Raymond looks a lot like Coffin Joe. So Raymond made this film, a short 10-minute long film called A Blind Date with Coffin Joe. He filmed it here in St. Louis. And he went out and bought the cape and the top hat and the long nails and grew his facial hair just like Coffin Joe's and learned Portuguese, because that's what Coffin Joe speaks, and made this hilarious short about this sort of airhead girl who goes out on a blind date with Coffin Joe. And Coffin Joe keeps talking about how he wants to mate and form the perfect race and all this stuff. And her friends show up and he kills all her friends. Anyway, this is crazy. This is where the story gets crazy. Coffin Joe ended up seeing this blind date of Coffin Joe. Now, in about 10 years ago, when Coffin Joe was in his 70s, he's in his 80s now, he decided he was going to make a new Coffin Joe movie called Embodiment of Evil down in Brazil. And he was going to film up some flashback scenes where he was a young man. So he actually flew Raymond from St. Louis down to Brazil. So Raymond plays the young Coffin Joe in this movie, Embodiment of Evil, from about 10 years ago. It's kind of like, what was that, The Rock Star with Mark Wahlberg, where he loved, was a Judas Priest or something, and he ended up becoming the lead singer. It kind of reminds me of that story a little bit. But anyway, I told this story to the Kathy Corley and James Harrison over at Webster U, And they thought it was a pretty cool story. So they're giving us October 9th, which is a Sunday, to do the Coffin Joe tribute. And we haven't quite figured out what we're going to do. I think what we're going to do is show This Night I'll Possess Your Corpse, which is one of the craziest Coffin Joe movies from 1967. And then we'll show This Embodiment Evil that Raymond's in. And Raymond will put on his Coffin Joe garb and introduce these movies. So put that on your calendar. I almost said put it on your coffin.
That's right. Tag it right on there.
And we'll be talking about that more as we get closer to that date, which again is October 9th, which is a Sunday. And one last thing. Vincent Price always packs them in St. Louis because Vincent Price is from St. Louis. Yeah. Did you know Vincent Price was from St. Louis?
Yeah.
What's your favorite Vincent Price movie?
That. I'm trying to remember if I've seen anything with him. I've seen sections of Last Man on Earth.
There you go. That's the one we're showing. July 7th, which is a Thursday. This is over at Schlafly Bottle Works as part of the... A film series, and it's a fundraiser for Helping Kids Together. Last Man on Earth, 1963, Vincent Price. It's a great movie.
Will the unbelievable become real? A world of inanimate zombies by day? Irresistible, horrifying attackers by night? Can a zombie woman's hunger for love repopulate the earth?
And I'll be doing Vincent Price trivia and all kinds of stuff. So we'll be talking about that some more, too. All right, let's move along. It is, what is today, June 13th or something like that.
Yes.
So it's getting pretty close to the halfway point of 2016. It's been a pretty good year for movies, I think. I even said in my review of Conjuring 2, it's been a particularly good year for horror films.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, there have been several good movies. But let's talk about our favorite movies so far in 2016. I think we have time to do a top five. Steven, what was your top five? What was your fifth favorite movie?
Here's my fifth favorite movie. My fifth favorite movie was Whit Stillman's Love and Friendship.
That's a good movie. You seen that yet, Jim?
Not yet. Got it.
It kind of resembles like a very Jane Austen, like Noah Baumbach movie to me.
Yeah.
Like where they're all speaking so fast and a lot of the actions in the dialogue. But I think the greatness of Love and Friendship comes from the fact that that suspense can be drawn by like extending a joke over an entire conversation in almost the same way that like a bomb under the table can. Because like they have these drawn out conversations and you're just waiting for the punchline and then bam, and it's hilarious.
It is. It's quite a funny movie, actually. Jim, what's your fifth favorite movie of 2016 so far?
Oh, I would put Eye in the Sky as my fifth favorite. That's a terrific
movie. That is a good movie.
Thriller.
What a suspenseful film that is.
Yeah, kind of tackling political issues that are pretty prevalent in this day and age, and with a great performance by Helen Mirren at its center, and a wonderful farewell performance by Alan Rickman. It's a terrific nail biter of film. Good performance by Aaron Paul too.
Wait a minute, didn't he do a voice in Alice?
Yeah, he did a voice in Alice.
His last live action appearance.
Let's forget about
Alice.
That.
Yeah,
all right,
yeah.
Number five for me, I have to say, would be Everybody Wants Some, which is Richard Linklater's sort of quasi follow up to. Dazed and Confused, about a bunch of college baseball players. Very funny movie. Very very well done. Very well acted. I'm surprised it didn't do more business, though.
Yeah.
It kind of came and went. I thought that was going to be something of an underground hit. But maybe there's no such thing as underground hits anymore. You know, maybe the only movies that make a lot of money are the big blockbusters. What was your number four favorite movie so far this year,
Steven? My number four is Jeff Nichols' Midnight Special.
Michelle likes that movie a lot.
I get why people probably do not like the ending to that movie, since it kind of... You know, it's a little bit anticlimactic, but as a full film, it is kind of a representation of Jeff Nichols' like view on the world and being a parent. He said that type of thing in interviews, and you can definitely see that, and that only bolsters the film. Plus, like, it's very intriguing, and the alien stuff was really, really cool.
All right. Jim, number four on your list so far this year.
Well, number four is going to be higher up on someone's list here, I'm sure. It's The Witch.
The Witch.
Which is my favorite horror film of the year so far.
Same here.
And it's so disturbing. I think we've mentioned several times, it stays with you. There are sequences I still kind of think about and have a little nightmares about.
The ending.
Yeah, the ending, the whole peekaboo sequence with the baby is just amazing.
Yeah.
And you'd think that witches had been played out in movies, but boy, this gives a whole new dimension to those to that horror trope. And boy, it's a really well done film.
It is. It's terrifying. Okay, number four for me was A Eye in the Sky, which Jim had as his number five. So Jim's already talked about Eye in the Sky, but I will reiterate, it's a terrific suspenseful thriller. And that brings us down to number three. Steven, what is your number three?
My number three is Shane Black's excellent The Nice Guys.
It's a
Private Eye film, much like his Lethal Weapon and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, but this has Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling playing characters so close to their real type archetypes that you immediately buy them as these characters, and it's all bolstered by the energy of 70s exploitation. Awesome.
All right, well, good.
Good.
Jim and I both saw that, and we had a few problems with it. I think it got a little convoluted. I think it's the first half was really superb.
I don't think it was convoluted at all.
Man, well, why is Ryan doing Lou Costello?
The ending was
a little goofy. But I'm glad you liked it. It's a very good movie. It's very good. I just don't think it was nearly as good as Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which is the movie that was most like it from Mr. Black. But that's okay. Jim, number three for you.
Well, this will be a little controversial. I know some people have some problems with it, but I don't think I've laughed harder to film this year so far as I did at Popstar, Never Stopping. I think this is going to be discovered on video in a few years. Yes.
No,
yes,
it is very funny.
It is very funny. It is. It does feel like a sketch, you know, from SNL stretched to its limits, but at least it's not trying to inject some pathos into it, which is the problem with The Boss with Melissa McCarthy. They want you to feel sorry for the character and love the character at the end of it, and you don't with Connor for real. He's still kind of a twit through the whole thing, but some of it, the cameos and the setups, and yeah, I know making fun of pop stars is fish in a barrel, but boy, it's funny.
All right, well, my number three is a movie that Jim and I saw last week. It's called Hell in High Water. I guess there's a bit of an embargo on this film, but there have been some reviews because it played at Cannes last year. It's about a pair of bank robbers who are trying to refinance their mother's home that's about to go into foreclosure. And so they rob banks. This takes place down in Texas in a bunch of depressed small towns in Texas. Jeff Bridges plays this sheriff who's on the eve of his retirement, and he's tracking these guys down. It's a really terrific crime film. It kind of reminded me of No Country for Old Men a little bit, that it's there's this terrific crime story, but it's all, you've got all these colorful Texas characters, and I think you're going to be hearing more about this movie, possibly even at award season. I can see Jeff Bridges getting a supporting actor nomination. He's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, we're going to talk a lot about that when it comes out in August.
Nice.
Didn't come out until August. Okay, that takes us to number two. Steven?
My number two of the year so far is The Lobster. It stars Colin Farrell and Rachel Weisz. And I think that The Lobster is such a well, it's a very deliberately structured movie because it's much like films like Gattaca or so. It's trying to get you into the mind space of the characters that live in that world. And I think that mind space is very cathartic. It's a lot about setting up an expectation and then bringing it down. And like, it kind of rolls over itself in that type of structure, and it's so well created. It's just excellent.
It's a great movie. Jim, what's your number two?
Number two is, I think, the feel-good hit of the year, Sing Street. It just came out of left field for me. I wasn't a big fan of the John Carney film so far, but boy, this just grabbed me with the 80s nostalgia and the energetic performances of the young cast and the great pop tunes. A terrific film.
All right, well, good. We got to speed this up a little bit because we're almost running out of time. Okay. My number two was also The Lobster. Steve and I have the same number two. What a great movie The Lobster was. I love The Lobster. I can't stop thinking about it. I want to see it again.
Crazy.
And that brings us to number one for Steven. Drum roll, please. Steven's number one favorite.
My number
so
one
far of 2016 is
Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some.
Oh, okay, that's right.
Such
well,
a
good.
Funny, heartfelt movie. It's about the times that kind of define you. And I think what's so great about it is how much energy the film builds, because the competitive nature of the characters isn't only about the baseball. It's also about, like, they're all competing for happiness and to have the best time and the joy. And it's just a great movie. Just a great time.
It's a great movie. It should be out on DVD pretty soon, I would imagine. I think
Jim's
number one film. I believe it's Barbershop 3.
You are wrong, Tom. And it's not Mother's Day either. No. It is Captain America Civil War.
Nice.
The film that gives you hope for the superhero franchise after the dismal Batman v Superman.
Oh,
it's great. Terrific new Spider-Man in it. A great introduction to Black Panther. This is the film that Avengers 2 should have been. It's a terrific, terrific film.
All right. And my number one film of the year so far, we've already discussed, it is The Witch. I can't get enough of The Witch. I've got the Blu-ray and I just watch it over and over. It's kind of like Mad Max. I just couldn't get enough of Mad Max, and The Witch just freaks me out. It's such a scary movie. It's really, I think, the scariest movie probably in the past decade or so. So that is our favorite movie so far this year, but we still got a, you know, we still got a, over a 6 months left,
yeah.
And all the awards contenders and things like that are going to be ahead of us, and not to mention Baywatch. With Alexandra Daddario in a bikini. That's the movie I'm most looking forward to during the rest of 2016. But we'll be back next week. We're going to review Central Intelligence and Finding Dory, and we'll get Michelle to call in again. But for now, Stephen Trotashek, thanks a lot for joining us. You did a great job, and we appreciate you contributing reviews for our site.
You're welcome.
All right, cool. We're going to sign off, though, now. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Betts.
Stephen Trotashek.
And be sure to listen to us again next week.
Black leather, ta-ta-ta. Black leather.
Oh, naughty state.